Hi, everybody. Welcome to Read Science, where my co-host Jeff and I love to talk with popular science book authors and writers and other people who communicate about science, about how they indeed communicate science with the general public in engaging and compelling ways. And one of the best people to do this is Ed Yong, and he is right here virtually with us today. Say hi to everybody, Ed.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited because here, you know, on Read Science, we usually talk to authors after their books have been published, but Ed's publisher was so kind to help set this up before his book comes out next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
In the U.S., September 1st in the U.K. with a different cover.
That's right.
But here is his book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. So, and I'm sure we will get around to talking about, you know, how you chose this title and actually mm-hmm. how the subtitle really captures this, the essence mm-hmm. of the book. Mm-hmm. Because you could have said, how to lose weight, make friends, earn money.
Oh, God, right.
With your microbiome, which is tends to be what they do. So, actually, so before I let you, Jeff, throw out the first question, let me read Ed's short bio here in the back of his book. I'm being lazy today. I didn't write something really long. So, Ed Yong, for those of you who don't know, is an award-winning science writer on the staff of The Atlantic. His blog, Not Exactly Rocket Science, is hosted by National Geographic Magazine. It used to be at Discover. And his work has appeared in The New Yorker, Wired, The New York Times, Nature, New Scientist, Scientific American, and The Guardian, The Times, Discover, Slate, and everywhere else you can find fine science writers. He lives in London and Washington, D.C. See, that's mm-hmm. what, if I ever have a bio, maybe not for a book, I wanted to say I live here and here.
That's right. He's very jet-lagged most of the time.
that's right. It's good when you're young. So
yeah, that's
okay.
Right.
And we are so glad to have you here. And I will be taking questions here. If you address them on Twitter or Google+, I can field them for you guys. Okay, Jeff, do you want to begin?
Thank you. It's great to have you here, and it's a real pleasure. And before we actually went on air, we were talking about some of the firsts for your book and Read Science programs, and one that I didn't get around to mentioning, but I was very excited about, is that I think yours, I'm pretty sure yours is the first book we've talked about that mentions American roller derby. So that's a pretty exciting accomplishment.
A little shout out to my friend Kate Clancy.
Yeah.
And all the other roller derby fans out there. Hi, Kate.
Now, I was very interested in the historic path that you've traced since the beginning, discovering what microbes are, the wonderful things about von Leeuwenhoek and his microscope, and how we've tried to understand microbes. And now it took you virtually all the book to prepare the ground to say this quotation I want to start with. But still, I want to start with it as a sort of top-level organizing theme that we can work our way down from. If this is the only question of the show, then fine. You can go ahead and say everything. But after a couple hundred pages, you wrote, say goodbye to dated and dangerous war metaphors in which we are soldiers hell-bent on eradicating germs at whatever cost. Say hello to a gentler and more nuanced gardening metaphor. Big change, and a lot has happened. And you don't have to cover it all at first, but what are we talking about? Let's ease our way into this.
Well, so what's interesting to me is that the point when microbes were first seen and discovered, they didn't have any of the negative connotations that have been glommed onto them, that we now associate with them. The first person who saw microbes with his own eyes was a man called Antony van Leeuwenhoek. He was a Dutch person. This happened in about 1675. And he was not a trained scientist. He was not a scholar. But he did have two qualities that were really important. He had the world's best microscopes, which he created himself, and he had an insatiable curiosity. Yeah. And he used the latter to turn the former upon the world around him. He used these superlative lenses to look at everything he could get his hands on. And in that spirit of curiosity, he looked at some water from various different sources. And in them, he saw these multitudes of little moving things. And that, I think, was surely, you know, one of the most incredible moments in all of biology, the point where people realize that beneath the threshold of their perception, life exists in untold numbers. And, you know, Leeuwenhoek looked everywhere he saw these microbes. He looked in his own body, he took scrapings of plaque from his teeth, and he looked there, and he found microbes too. He saw them in the mouths of the citizenry of Delft, his neighbors, his friends, and he wasn't disgusted. I think that's the critical thing. He was really excited to learn about this vast community of organisms that shared his body. He didn't go, oh God, that's gross. That is a modern point of view, one that we have gained because of later work showing that all of these disastrous plagues that have affected people for centuries and millennia, so everything from actual plague to cholera to typhoid, were the result of germs. And because all these discoveries came in such a short span of time, that's how we came to portray them. We saw them as villains and as antagonists. And it's only recently, I think, that we have begun to reclaim the kind of boyish excitement that Leeuwenhoek had when he first saw the microbiome, when he first saw bacteria and other microbes that live in and on the bodies of animals. Because we're starting to realize that, in fact, they have a really important role in our lives. They help to shape our bodies, they sculpt our organs, they calibrate our immune system, digest our food. All of these things are these things that we think of as the province of individuals, health and digestion and development and all of that stuff, is really the result of conversations, of partnerships between different organisms, of which we are just one party. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a magnificent view of the world around us. It's one that that we have started to appreciate, and I think that does recast microbes from things that are gross, from things that are signs of dirt and disease, things that we need to destroy and get rid of, to things that we need to live in harmony with, to things that we need to appreciate for all the benefits that they give to us. And it's not to say that suddenly, like, all microbes are good. It's more that they are massively influential. The animal kingdom, so, you know, the book isn't just about humans, it's about the animal world as well. Mm-hmm. This whole world, the world of zoos and David Attenborough documentaries and all of that, this world that we can see and that we're familiar with is profoundly influenced by another world that we cannot see, but is really important. And that's what I wanted to talk about with this book. You know, that's why I chose the subtitle. That is the grander view of life that I wanted to convey to people. That we all exist in partnership, and we're all influenced by these tiny living things.
Discovering this world of bacteria and then discovering the association between so many horrid diseases at the time and mm-hmm. developing the idea of germ theory, this was mm-hmm. a great breakthrough, surely, in understanding and gave us a lot of valuable things. But has that view has also tainted scientists' viewpoint of the microbiome, and it's taken some time, hasn't it, to start to see the good in what's going on and uncover that as well.
I think it has, and you know, I think we shouldn't go overboard and start thinking that, you know, all infectious disease biology has been wrong all this time. Obviously, it hasn't. Microbes can cause illnesses, but it's clear that you know, only a minority of them do so, and the majority are either benign or possibly beneficial to us. And you know, the way we think about these things, the metaphors we use, you know, you highlighted the thing I said about militaristic metaphors. You know, these frames that we put on the world view changes how we see ourselves and how we see the world around us, and the types of science we do. So you know, that bit you quoted comes from a description of the immune system. And I think the immune system has traditionally been viewed as this sort of militaristic defense force that separates self from non-self. So everything that is us and human to everything that is foreign and alien. And traditionally, microbes have been included in the latter category. But obviously, we house a lot of microbes, we tolerate them, and they are part of us, and they are, many of them, they do important things for us. And now it's clear that among those influences is microbes also affect the development of various parts of the immune system. They set it up correctly, and then they calibrate it. So they set the balance between inflammation responses that help to control infections and anti-inflammation, so stopping us from overreacting to harmless threats in the world around us, whether it's the microbes that share our lives or allergens in the environment, that sort of thing. So if we didn't have any microbes with us at all, if we never encountered them in our lives, we wouldn't be able to strike that right balance between reaction and overreaction. And our immune systems would be the sort of twitchy... and maybe that's true. Maybe that is, in fact, what is happening to us. So rather than this this defense force, this stuff about self and non-self, you know, I like to see the immune system as a set of ecosystem managers, like a set of rangers in a national park. They're deciding, they're helping to control the species in the park. They're not sort of eradicating everything, but they're chucking out invasive ones, making sure that the populations are at the right level, you know, just managing that ecosystem. And that I think is what, it's that kind of thinking that we need to grasp, that we need to understand that we are ecosystems in our own rights, that we are these vast communities of life, and that all the aspects of biology that we're familiar with need to account for that broader picture.
I'm so glad you mentioned self and non-self. When I was reading about the enormous numbers of bacteria, and so I'd like you to mention that. But it made me think of Temple Grandin in one of her earlier books, who had written about her idea. She felt like many of the repetitive and sometimes damaging motions that people with autism sometimes display, she felt was their attempt to reinforce their idea of where the edges of their bodies were. Because, and she says, and she identified, I thought this was a very perceptive problem. It's like, how do we know where the edges of our body are? And that I was thinking, and, you know, is your idea of what it means of, you know, what our body is and what we are changed by the time you got to the end of this book? Because it gets complicated to say what a human is now.
Yeah, very, very much so. You know, other scientists who work in this field have talked about this idea that it changes. It certainly affects what we mean by individuality. You know, what we think, when we're describing something as an individual, what do we mean by that? Are we talking about the confines of their body? Are we talking about their genome, the fact that they develop from a single cell into an adult? You know, all of these things are deeply influenced by microbes. You know, we know that microbes affect the growth and development of our organs. We know that they they aren't seen by, a lot of them aren't seen by the immune system as non-self and then destroyed, that they are parts of our bodies. You know, they can be treated as considered as a living organ composed of trillions of cells and thousands of species. So every way in which you cut to the concept of individuality, microbes insinuate themselves. You know, they complicate matters. And then when you talk about the boundaries of your own bodies, in the last chapter in the book, I talk about how microbes connect us to the world around us. You know, I spend 9 chapters talking about ourselves and how they influence our lives. But then the last one is meant to just make us go even broader than that. I'm sitting here bleeding microbes into this flat around me. You know, I swipe the surface, I pick up microbes from the world around me onto my skin. There is this constant traffic to and fro my built environment into my body. And I think in that way, the science of the microbiome, you know, not only expands our horizons and our understanding of who we are, but also connects us to the world at large and makes us think about not only the communities that live with us, but those that we have inadvertently set up in the world around us and how those two are linked.
It's interesting because actually, as I was reading your chapter about, you know, families and, you know, even roommates and how they start to share some, you know, of the microbiome similar organisms and things like that. And I thought, you know, it's very, as here we are speaking virtually, and there are surely more long distance relationships. I wonder, you know, someone's going to come along and say, yeah, you know, people who share more of their microbiome for a larger percent of the year are, you know, are destined to be closer or destined to break apart. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because your book just really, as a biologist, I'm like, oh, I've heard of this. But then I thought, wow, I just started to really broaden what, you know, what else will they say the microbiome might be implicated.
My God, I feel like already set up like a microbiome matchmaking service. It is bound to be related. Whether there's any robust science behind it or not, I am not convinced. But that has never stopped anyone from starting a business about anything. So watch the space. I'm sure.
Exactly. I read the last chapter and just talking about the spaces we lived in, and boy, did I like that story of how Gilbert was able to go into a brand new hospital, nobody in there yet, swab everything, and then start to follow it as it becomes popular with people and doctors. And I was like, I had no idea this was going on. This is fascinating.
And, you know, it makes you realize that the hospital is just like any other environment, and it's just like us. You know, if a new island rises from the sea, it will be predictably colonized by lichens and moss first, and then shrubs, and then maybe trees if it's big enough. And you get these patterns of ecological succession, which are very familiar and very predictable. Same thing happens, when a new building is erected, and the same thing happens when a baby is born. You get these waves of microbial species colonizing their guts, their skins, everything, and it happens in the same way. So some species rise to the fore early, some colonize late, and I think understanding that, realizing that, it makes you see that we are just another habitat. Another ecosystem to the organisms that have been living on this planet longest and that are most dominant in it. You know that our bodies are just the same as like a drop of water or a patch of soil or something like that. You know, we are just another microbial world.
And you told us that it takes a baby's microbiome up to 3 years to reach what we might call an adult stage, and that's we're coming to see as a really important thing. And I don't know, that with the idea of antibacterial soaps and good things you have to say about living with dogs, it's very good. It's like the importance of seeing that germs have a useful thing, and that's finally coming along and what can be done with it. I think I guess the observation you can take off from this, but I made a note about page 200 where I said something like, I'm finally beginning to see that, that what I am is much more than just the phenotype of my genotype.
Yeah, very much so. You know, and that's, I think, even clearer when you look at other species. So I talk about so many examples of animals that are very dependent on their microbes for important skills. So there are bugs, there are sap-sucking insects that have bacteria inside their cells that act as dietary supplements that provide those animals with nutrients that are missing from those meals. Without those microbes, those insects would be completely unable to make to lead the lifestyle that they lead, and they would have never been as evolutionarily successful as they are now, with some like 85,000 different kinds of aphids and cicadas and leafhoppers and all the rest. You know, in the deep ocean, there are worms and clams and all kinds of other deep sea creatures that have taken that idea even further. So they, you know, guts, they don't eat anything because they rely on microbes and bacteria to provide them with energy through chemosynthesis by oxidizing sulfur in order to get the energy to make the food they need instead of harnessing the power of sunlight. And, you know, there are animals that that by taking in the right microbes are able to detoxify the poisons in the food that they eat. So there are bugs that can become instantly resistant to insecticides if they swallow the right soil microbes. There are wood rats that can eat the most common plants in the deserts around them if they get the right microbes in their guts. So yeah, I think it's very clear that bacteria and other microbes have vastly expanded the evolutionary potential of their animal hosts, allowing them to sort of transcend their basic animalness and to take up opportunities to lead lifestyles that would have been otherwise completely blocked off to them. And they have added their genetic wealth, their powers at biochemistry to our own, and supplemented ours in ways that have led to extraordinary gains for some animal groups.
And in many cases, then these animal species who are inadvertently working with the microbes are able to make fast evolutionary leaps in a short time. Are able to acquire these characteristics without going through the mechanism that we understand of changing their own genotype.
Right. So I like to think of this as you know, you work in a company and you lack a certain skill set. Well, you can either train your own employees to have those skills very slowly, or you can just hire someone who already has that. And that's what we can do by partnering with the right microbes. We can instantly gain access to abilities that they have. And I think I'm very clear in the book, and I think this is important, that this is not like some grand rewriting of evolutionary theory. You know, the microbes are still evolving in the usual slow, gradual Darwinian way. What all we're doing is accelerating the pace of our own evolution by taking advantage of their adaptations, the ones that they have accrued in that slow way. You know, it's not anything different to what Darwin saw. It's just faster. You know, I think it was Greg Hurst who said to me that bacteria allow us to do impressions of bacteria, and I think he's right. You know, by partnering them, we can gain new adaptations with the kind of blistering pace that they can. I think that's fascinating to me.
And the bacteria, of course, are still evolving all the time, and we're worried about resistant bacteria now in hospitals and things. Bacteria are pacing along and evolving all the time still.
That's right. And, you know, one thing that actually hasn't been that much work done on this is the evolution of our own microbiomes, like within our own bodies. Like, how do they change? These are, as you say, living, constantly evolving organisms. They have their own evolutionary interests. So what happens to them when we do different things? You know, we sort of people like to treat the microbiome as this, as almost like a fixed entity. You can go for like a microbiome test or whatever, but it changes all the time. You know, species rise and fall and they evolve. So how does that play out? And, you know, we have people, so I think Eric Alm from MIT showed that so for readers who aren't familiar with this, bacteria can swap genes. They can trade DNA horizontally, so that one cell can pass DNA to another and trade adaptations in that way. And those horizontal gene transfers happen much more frequently in the human body, within the context of the human microbiome, than they do in a lot of other external environments, which makes total sense, because we are concentrating them in very large communities, in very densely packed spaces. So, of course, they were giving them loads of opportunities to exchange genes. And I think the consequences of those exchanges are still unclear. You know, there's a really famous example where the gut bacteria in Japanese people seem to have picked up this gene for digesting the carbohydrates that are found in seaweed. Because they picked it up from marine microbes. So presumably in the past, Japanese diners swallowed uncooked seaweed and with it microbes that had the capacity to digest that foodstuff. And those genes then passed on to the microbes that still persist in our gut. And that's one example, but there are almost certainly many more that we don't know about.
Right. So you actually have on page 119, it says here, and although human genes don't change fast enough to account for the sudden rise in IBD, but microbes do. And that's, you know, this was really fascinating to me that, and even this whole concept of the hollow genome, which in any time we talk about evolution in biology, somebody's going to have an argument. And we're not even talking an argument of whether you believe in evolution or not. We're talking within the ranks. And you mentioned that in this book, and I thought, wow, that's so true. So, talk a little bit about this hollow genome. Like, how can we say this microbiome has a whole genome, you know, like,
Right. So I think the idea is to treat the host and the microbes as this holistic entity upon which selection acts. So rather than selection acting just on the level of individual genes, we're taking a broader, more holistic view of this entire community. And you know, to an extent, it makes sense because obviously microbes are affecting the fit. You know, you can look. The microbes are affecting the fitness of their host. There's variation in the microbiome. It's inherited. So there's all the ingredients for natural selection to be acting there. But I think the argument with the hologenome is whether that framework, whether treating these things as a whole rather than a separate part, adds anything to evolutionary theory. Whether it gives us something that just talking about, say, symbiosis, this concept that's been around for much longer, whether it adds anything on top of that. I think that the hologenome debate is really interesting, and it's fascinating to me that it gets quite vitriolic sometimes, even though it's about, you know, unity and cooperation to an extent. But I think it's sort of being ironed out, right? So it's in many ways it's a question of framing. So what does the term even mean? And you know, definitions are seeming to are like slowly morphing. We're getting a clear idea of what people are thinking of when they say hologenome. And then, you know, I think what we'll need is to show that this concept gives us new things, that it that it makes predictions about the world around us that are different to what we have. It rather than just being a sort of nice metaphor, a nice lens through which we see existing biology, whether it hints at other things that we didn't know about, whether it can be solidified and codified in a very rigorous mathematical way, in the way that like the gene-centric view of evolution has been.
Scientifically.
Absolutely.
Isn't it less important that whether it's correct or not in a way than whether it's a productive idea?
I think that's a fair statement. And you know, in the book, I don't come down on either side of this debate because I think it's still ongoing. And certainly, it was getting, you know, quite heated when I was writing this thing about a year ago. But I think for the moment, as far as I'm concerned, it sort of doesn't matter. Like, what I really want to do is get that baseline understanding that microbes are important, that they influence so many aspects of our biology. And, you know, whether how you frame it, whether you view it as a whole genome or not, we can argue the toss about that in years to come, and almost certainly will. But I think I wanted to focus on just how important these things are, what a crucial contribution they make to our lives.
Right, and actually, so I want to take this moment here to thank you for several things. Okay, first of all, is you feature scientists. You could you could talk about all of this without mentioning a single name, but it's very clear you visited scientists. You spoke at length with them if you didn't visit in person and see their labs and things like that. You know, and you made them real people who are doing real work. And, you know, I'll have you go into detail for in that a little bit. But the other thing you show, not just the scientists, but the process. And, you know, so if we're talking primarily about bacteria, you know, the book covers viruses and fungus as well. But, you know, how many experiments require that you administer an antibiotic, remove the, and then seed with the bacteria you want and see what happens? You know, so you are clearly demonstrating how some of these scientists went about the methodology to show these things are happening. It's not just conjecture, it's what they discovered. And then, you know, finally, the book does not say, this is right. If you have these bacteria, you won't be fat. You know, you definitely indicate and you know, make the point quite strongly that this is still an evolving science. I guess no pun intended on that, but that it's you know, really still controversy. So when you see a headline, maybe take it with a grain of salt, sit back and wait. Don't run out and try and buy the next probiotic that promises if you have a better balance between this and Firmicutes, you're going to be, you know, a fit. Right.
Yeah, thank you very much for pointing out those two things. Those were really important to me when I was thinking about the book and thinking about how to approach it. I mean, I've always been interested in stories first and foremost, and you know, the book, I never wanted the book to be just like a review or a textbook or anything like that. You know, I wanted it to be rich with stories. You know, in many ways, it's an ideas-driven book. There is no like single narrative that runs through. But this idea of that this field is so rife with narratives, so there's loads of them throughout the book. There's so many personal stories from the people who've been involved in this, you know, people who've spent decades teasing apart the secrets of squid or of mosquitoes, you know, of mice. And they are wonderful, colorful characters. You know, I've loved talking to the scientists who work in this area. I've loved going to conferences and hanging out with them. You know, I don't know whether it's because they work on issues of cooperation and symbiosis and, you know, this, you know, unity and conversations and stuff like that, but they generally are a very nice field. They're a very nice bunch of people to spend time with. And, you know, I interviewed hundreds, like maybe a couple of hundred scientists for this book. I visited, you know, a dozen labs or so. I went to several conferences, and it was really good fun, and I wanted to show the stories behind the discoveries, you know, so it wasn't just going to be here's the science, here's this thing, and this study, and that study. You know, I wanted to show, like, how we got to where we are, some of the history, how much work it takes to arrive at this level of understanding, and still how far we have left to go. So I hope that it's a book that not only tells people about science, but also shows what real science is like, how it progresses, and the stories of the people behind it. And you know, the other thing you mentioned about acting sort of as an antidote to hype, I that was important to me too, because I am a journalist. My job is to provide a very fair reflection that, you know, and not fall prey to hype and exaggeration. You know, I'm so excited about this area of science, but I also don't want to mislead my readers. So when areas are controversial, I do talk about that. I try and make it clear what we know and what we don't know. You know, all the answers that we've attained, but all the questions that are still to come. one. And that's why it was important to me right from the start that I Contain Multitudes is not going to be a self-help book or a diet book or anything of that kind. It is, as far as I'm concerned, primarily a natural history book. It is a book about the world around us and how much more wondrous it becomes when we look at the microbes that influence our lives. And obviously, there are health elements to that. You know, the book talks a lot about that. But I want to, you know, it's not going to be the thing that says, here is how you're going to, you know, like you said, the microbiome is going to make you live longer, run faster. It's going to make your hair shiny and glossy. It's going to give you. You're going to be able to catch all the Pokemon. It's not like that. It's in such an early stage of discovery, and I see that all the time in the papers that I cover in my day job, and I wanted to convey that in the book. And I think, you know, I can understand that some people might be frustrated with that. You know, people want answers about their health and their bodies. But I think I feel that it's almost more exciting to be on this precipice, you know, to be on this wave of discovery that's not even crested yet. You know, so I want to gear people up for the ride ahead. That was always a crucial thing, right from the start. I was definitely trying to not get one of Jonathan Eisen's Overselling the Microbiome Awards.
Yes, yes. I thought Jonathan would appear in the book. Yes, hi, Jonathan. Yeah, we just love him. So, you know, it's funny, your book. It's funny. I'm reading your book, and I'm aware of your humor. I've read a lot of your work. I've met you in person. So, you know, and I was like keeping my eye out for funny things, but you do humor in a very subtle way in your books, and I like this.
British.
He is British, yeah.
He is British, after all, exactly. So so there were two incidents where a man gets impaled with a bit of a tree, and then a kid falls out of a tree or into a tree or something,
yeah, that's
right. And he gets a bit, and so there's bacteria that to be found from this that, you know, created some great discoveries. But you just say, forget Fritz, that's the man, and forget the kid. They're fine, and perhaps more cautious now about arboreal safety. Let's talk about, like, and then you just turn right away. And so the book is full of these little tiny bits of humor that I was like, you know, they just make me smile, and I love it. And I also want to say, thank you for not using well-worn cliches as your metaphors. It would fill two football fields. I'm like, I hear.
Right, yeah. How many double-decker buses? How many swimming pools full of bacteria would there be?
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
So all of your metaphors are fresh and subtle and, you know, but relatable. And I like this. This is, you know, one of the things you excel at, which makes
you
a favored writer. And, you know, it's funny, so even if you're not at certain conferences or on certain panels, those of us who know you, suddenly your name pops up, and we're all, oh, yes, you've got some dead young. So don't blush too much.
Thank you.
You can match my wall.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, and the top, too.
But while you're on the subject of metaphors, would you go ahead and try to... wow people's mind by explaining how extraordinarily large a number the payload is of an individual person's microbiome.
I mean,
numbers do things to my mind.
Well, it's astonishing, right? I mean, the tricky thing here is that it's very hard to count them because they're so vast. And you know, there's this famous 10-to-1 ratio. So we have 10, we're, you know, 10% human, 10 microbial cells for every human ones. And it seems that that's actually, it's just a back of the envelope calculation that some people like pull out of the net. And the most recent estimate suggests that it's roughly 1-to-1. So you know, at most, I am about half the person who I think I am. You know, that proportion probably changes throughout the day. It depends on whether I eat, whether I've just gone to the toilet or not. You know, so we may not be mostly microbe, but we are substantially so. I love that idea. I love the thought of that I am a community. I am colony, a collective. You know, I went to a I went to a facility at the University of Washington in St. Louis, which raises germ-free mice. There are a lot of these facilities around the world. And I got to meet one of these rodents. He lives his entire life in these sterile isolators. It's completely disconnected from the microbial world. And like, you know, there are gloves that you can that stick into these bubbles. You can put your hands in and hold one of these things. But you know, it looks like a mouse, but it's one of the I was just struck by the fact that it must be one of the strangest animals on the planet. It was one of the only ones that has no microbiome. And you know, it felt like I was looking just at like the silhouette of a mouse. You know, someone had sketched the outline of a mouse and not like colored it in. Because it doesn't, you know, it does not contain multitudes. And I thought that really got to me. I think it made me realize that how important this side of our biology is, how important these partnerships can be.
You talked about it at one point, I don't know, here, I can quote you, that there is a huge void between the simple cells of bacteria and archaea, and the more complex one of eukaryotes, and life has managed to cross that void exactly once in 4 billion years. And so we're beginning to see this, fairly new to me, this idea that mitochondria in our cells, which play this vital role and have been there for ages, and that we divide into these kingdoms between prokaryotes and eukaryotes and now archaea, is a different form of getting along with a bacterium that somehow took up residence, and that thing that happened once, and then horizontal gene transfer, and gosh, all sorts of stuff. And I don't really know that I have a question, but it's an amazing
you want me
thing.
You want to wax lyrical about mitochondria?
but you know, it's not like
mitochondria.
It's not like the idea of sharing our lives with microbes is a new thing, because we think we understand now that we've done it from the beginning when we separated from single simple-celled animals, right?
Well, when we arose from them, I mean, so a couple of things here. Yeah, the mitochondria, the little power. Having just said that I avoid cliches. Mitochondria, the powerhouses of the cell, are in all of us, and they're vital, and they used to be bacteria. They came from free-living bacteria that have since become domesticated parts of our cells. And, you know, there's some debate about when exactly this happened. People like Nick Lane and Bill Martin and others think that that moment when a bacterium infused with an archaean and created this new type of cell was the origin of eukaryotes. Others would say that our cells had already started moving towards eukaryoteness before the mitochondria came in. Now, you know, you can argue about those, but I think the point is that mitochondria are ancient. We have been we've been forming partnerships with bacteria since before animals even existed. And then when animals did evolve, obviously, we did so in a microbial world, a world that was filled and dominated by microbes. And this was important to me because when talking to a lot of scientists who work in this field, especially on the subject of development, so how microbes shape the bodies of animals and influence the immune system and you know, our digestion, our guts, our minds, all these things. One question I kept on asking people was, so why? Because it seems so strange to kind of outsource these really crucial aspects of our lives to other organisms. And the answer that always came back was, well, what choice did we have? It seems completely inevitable. And that really shifted my view of the story, like early on in the reporting. Like, of course they're right. Like it is inevitable. Like when we arose in this context, we had no choice but to adapt to it, to learn to live with microbials, to exploit the chemicals and signals that they produce. And then we came to depend upon them. It's not like animals have evolved in a vacuum and they went, oh no, microbes. I wonder what we can do with those. You know, they were first. They had primacy. And then we plugged ourselves into their biology. I think that's, you know, that's a really crucial insight from this field.
Mm-hmm. And selective pressures don't strive to use a particular process or to try to do the best of it. They use whatever's lying around to make things happen.
Exactly. Right. You know, so like I write about, for example, these tube worms that can only become adults if they encounter the right microbial signals. So if they're drifting the ocean as larvae, when they meet the right bacteria, then they suddenly metamorphose mm-hmm. into adults. Mm-hmm. And you know, that seemed bizarre to me. But then, of course, the presence of bacteria signals many important things in the ocean. If there are loads of them on the surface, they say, well, first there's a solid surface upon which you can grow a worm. That surface is probably free of it's not going to be toxic because there's loads of living things there. There's probably going to be enough nutrients around. So it's an indicator. Those bacterial cues provide information to an animal which you can use to make life decisions. I'd say decisions in inverted commas. Generally, of course, these creatures learned, evolved to make use of those cues. Mm-hmm. It just makes sense.
And doing that turned out to be a successful tactic.
Yeah, very much so. It seems to pervade the entire ocean. So, a lot of work has been done with this tube worm, Hydrodes elegans, H. elegans. But mm-hmm. it seems to also apply to, I don't know, corals and sea anemones and all kinds of marine invertebrates. So, you know, the waters of the world are full of little larvae that need to encounter bacteria to become the adult state.
Yeah, I finish that up or carry on, but to quote one of the people you talked with several times, Margaret MacPhail Nye, if I've got that.
Yeah, that's right.
You quote her once as saying, "We now know that microbes make up the vast diversity of the biosphere, that they live in intimate association with animals, and that animal biology was shaped by interacting with microbes." Mm-hmm. Well, of course. But how long did it take to get to that view that we have an intimate association?
Yeah. You know, well, it took a very long time because, you know, we think we're kind of a big deal. I tried to point out in the book that we are but a footnote on the evolutionary story. You know, we are the icing on evolution cake. We have been around. I use this framing device of condensing down the history of the planet into a single calendar year. And if you do that, then humans arose about half an hour ago, whereas bacteria have been around since I think the transition between February and March. So for the vast majority of life on Earth, life was microbial, and bacteria had the run of the planet, and you know you could very easily argue that they still do. It is we like to think of it as the Anthropocene because we are kind of big on ourselves. But it is the microbiocene, and it always has been. I think giving a little bit more respect and appreciation to the tiny little sides of tiny little things in the world is no bad thing. Because it's our planet, we're just sort of squatting in it.
Yeah. You know, I want to repeat something that I actually said to Ed before the show. So those of you who are, maybe you're not a biologist, but you want to know what essential things should you know about biology, I have to say, so overall, there's a general consensus. There'll be some arguments, as always, in science, but that we cover certain topics in biology if we are to introduce someone to biology or over the course of a period of study. So let's say you get your undergraduate degree. So you are going to encounter the flow of energy, photosynthesis, mm-hmm. chemosynthesis, where does carbon go, things like that.
Yeah, right.
The interconnectedness and diversity of life. You will talk about inheritance, how do we pass on these traits. We talk about evolution by natural selection and ecosystems, of course, which is a part of that interconnectedness. And then we talk about the central dogma, how information flows from DNA to RNA to proteins. Now, when I read Ed's book, I was floored because it covers everything except the central dogma. No, not in detail, and it doesn't say, here is how this happens.
Yeah.
But you know, this just shows you do have a background in biology.
Yeah.
You are no stranger. You're a journalist, but you're no stranger to biology. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
I've done my time. I did science at university. I worked in a lab for two slightly frustrating abortive years. But this is the stuff I love. And if anyone wants to hand me their copy of the book at a signing or whatever, I will draw the central dogma on your front page. So just to complete this. I think this touches on something important, which is that the science of the microbiome isn't just about health, isn't just about obesity or asthma or whatever. It's not just about probiotics or fecal transplants and all those things that dominate the headlines. It is about all of biology. It unites so many fields. It unites zoology, botany, neuroscience, ecology, immunology, all of these things. And because microbes are not only exemplars of these things, but they influence the way these fields touch upon our lives. Evolution, development, ecology, health and medicine, all of these things. And I think that's almost the story of the microbiome. Like, it started, the realization that microbes were important took place in a lot of these very disparate silos in people who were studying insect microbes or the mouth or the guts or just random rivers and ponds and from those fringes they coalesced into a whole. They moved towards the center because people started realizing that they were finding parallels between all of these ecosystems, and they started realizing just how important microbes were in all of these different settings and disciplines. And I think that who was it? Was it Dobzhansky who said nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution?
Right.
Someone's been fact-checking me on the internet. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if I got that wrong, a queue of people will be telling me on Twitter right now. But one could argue that's true. Yes, that is absolutely true. But you could also argue that important throughout in the same broad way, right? It just touches on so much of what we study in the world around us.
But it's even bigger, so that physicists like me don't feel left out. I want to note that on page 51, you wrote this sentence: "It begins with physics."
Yes, that's right. Let's put that on a TV shirt, ignore the context,
and see. Throw your phone to the physicist.
I felt so much better after that.
So I am a biologist by training, and I'm not a physicist. You may note that the subsequent sentences after that line are a little thin on the old physics.
But
it begins with physics.
Problem. Yes.
Hand waving explanation, forces and stuff. I don't know.
Oh, we're very good with hand waving and backs of the envelopes.
That's right. Imagine a spherical microbe.
Exactly.
In a vat.
Very good, very good.
I have other little things. This is sort of the rapid what's it round, but you claim to have a favorite bacterium.
Yeah, that's right.
Which, if I practiced, I could pronounce, but it's Wolbachia.
Wolbachia, yeah. So Wolbachia I love for many reasons.
And as the book went on, I began to see why you would think it. It's a pretty special bacterium, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very cool. I quite liked the idea that Wolbachia itself was a character that sort of runs throughout the book. If Jonathan Eisen is watching this, he will point out to me that Wolbachia is in probably many different species. Hi, Jonathan. let us note that and proceed with just Wolbachia as a singular concept. Different strains do different things. Some are like sexual parasites. They massively distort sex ratios in the host that they infect because they pass down the Others are mutualists. They have they have beneficial effects on their hosts. They provide they act as dietary supplements. They help these caterpillars that eat leaves stop leaves from yellowing, so they have more to eat through the autumn. But they have benefits for us too. They seem to stop if you load it up into mosquitoes. They become really mm-hmm. bad hosts for a lot of the pathogens that cause diseases, like the viruses that cause dengue and Zika, possibly the parasite behind malaria. So scientists are trying to, an organization called Eliminate Dengue mm-hmm. is trying to use Wolbachia infected mosquitoes to turn wild ones into dead ends for these diseases. And it's a very solid and workable idea, because once you unleash Wolbachia into a wild population, it's very good at spreading. So I like the story because it has so many different sides to it. It is a microbe with many faces, many, you know, both positive and negative. You know, blue skies biology and very strong, powerful clinical applications. And I think it highlights the worthiness of exploring the microbial world. This bug was discovered by two scientists in 1924, Hertig and Wolbach. Wolbach, you know, Hertig named the species after his friend. And they had no idea what it was. They had no idea it was common, whether it was important, what it, you know, all the various manipulations that it posed. They couldn't predict that it would one day be looked to as a way of saving millions of lives from loads of really terrible tropical diseases. And I think it just goes to show how powerful it can be to just poke around the world around us with a curious mind and good tools, in the way that Leeuwenhoek did when he first discovered mm-hmm. microbes 350 mm-hmm. years ago. That mm-hmm. same theme, that same fascination with the world around us, is what led to not only all we know about microbiology, but then the harnessing of certain elements of it to save lives. You know, and that's what I want to do with the book. I want to get people mm-hmm. thinking about this. I want to open their eyes up to this grander view of life.
Right. It's amazing. The title is apt and was amazing. I knew I was in for a good read, but I really, really, really enjoyed it. And, you know, sometimes as a biologist, I look at books on biology and go, well, I'll know a lot of this stuff, but I love to read mm-hmm. how people put the stories together. You know, and of course I learn things, because this is not my necessarily, yeah, I'm a cell biologist, but I'm not a microbiologist. So we are down to our last few minutes. Mm-hmm. I guess I read in your acknowledgments that you weren't necessarily interested in writing a book, but suddenly you were interested in writing a book, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Will there be another book? You can tell us that story, but also tell us, now that you've done one, will you recover and then do another one, or just say that's it?
So the story of the book is that I did not want to write. I had no plans to write a book. I didn't have an idea. I sent Will, the man who's now my agent, and Will kept on pestering me, asking me, do you have any ideas? And I went, no, Will, no, Will, no, Will. I sent him this email saying, please stop, I have no ideas, never going to write a book. Many people tease me for saying the same things to them. Jen will never let me live this down. And then, like, 2 weeks after, I sent Will an email saying, please ignore previous email. Here is my book idea. Someone hacked my emails. So I was drunk, maybe. I don't know. So the idea came very quickly. You know, I've been reporting on this for a long while, and just very suddenly I realized that this was what I wanted to do. Part of it was realizing that, you know, like I said, I didn't want to write a human microbiome book. I didn't want to make it health or like diet focused or whatever. Realizing that I could do a book that looked across the entire animal kingdom and drew these parallels between very different types of biology and sort of weave it together into this like broad sweeping, you know, natural history book that included us as part of it. That was the moment where I thought, okay, this is a book. I know what I want to write about. I know who the people are. I've talked to them. I've written about their papers. Like, here are the labs I want to visit. Here are the themes I want to hit. Like, I went from, oh, maybe I could write a book about this, to like two pages that were just everything. Like the idea, the list of sources, everything. Like, send that to Will. within like a month, we had the proposal. Like we had 4,000 word essay and like a chapter plan. This thing was just bubbling in my head for a long time, and then it just went. Is there another idea like that? At the moment, no. will I write a second book? I'm more than willing to do so, but at the moment, I think I'm going to bed into the new Atlantic gig. You know, enjoy bouncing around between between London and DC. But I think you know, I said I wasn't going to write a book, and then I wrote a book. I said I was never going to go full-time freelance in 2011, and then 2 months later, I was a freelancer. I said to Ginny Hughes that I was never going to go back to full-time work last June, and then I joined The Atlantic about like a month later. So the moral of the story is I am an unreliable source on myself and should not be trusted to you whether I'm going to do a second book or not. So I'm going to say that I have no plans to do so at the moment, but frankly, I'm full of shit. So who knows?
You know, Scott Hewler, who you know, and we've had him on the show, he says, you know, you aren't going to write a book unless you have this thing inside of you where you want to grab people on the street and tell them about it, right? Because, writing a book is very difficult work. And, yeah, I get asked about writing a book all the time, and I'm like, and what is your premise for this? Oh, well, you have a lot of followers. I'm like, that sounds like a dumb way.
That is not a good reason to, right.
That's what I say. I'm like, how about someone has a great idea, someone is a good writer.
Will, my long-suffering agent, asked me, he said, you know, any ideas for a second book? I said, not really, I don't have one. And he said, you know, that's a good thing, because I think the biggest mistake people make is to rush into a second book. You know, you're so desperate to do one that you scrabble for ideas and you end up accepting an idea that you frankly would have rejected if it would have been for your first book, because it wouldn't have been strong enough. Mm-hmm. So then he asked me the same question like 4 months later, and I said, but Will, you told me, like, don't rush into the second book. That was your key piece of advice. And he went, that's terrible advice. I am your agent, and I want you to write a second book. Second book. Ignore past me.
That's great. Well, everybody, thank you for joining us and for learning about the microbiome with Ed Yong. And I highly recommend his book, I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and A Grander View of Life. This is a marvelous book, destined to be a classic. That's my prediction. Mm-hmm. I can't say whether these things come true or not, but it's from a biologist standpoint, this is essential reading. I hope people who come to this book thinking, oh, it's going to tell me what I need to eat to have a healthy life, because it's got the good microbes or whatever, won't be disappointed, and instead will have their eyes open to the grander view of life.
I hope so.
So thank you, Ed, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, thank you, Jeff, as always.
It's a pleasure, and I'll add that I thoroughly enjoyed every page of this book, and it works for non-biologists, too. Thanks, Ed.
Appreciate it. So those of
you
who are...
Such a pleasure talking to you.
So glad to have Ed on. Those of you who are listening right now, we talk to Dr. Karen Bondar next week. So we'll see you again soon on Read Science.